Livewire with Jeff Dorset.
Voted the best ever act by MTV Europe and having a number one across at least 25 countries is not too shabby for my guest, the star of Rick Rollin'. And as Martin Fry of ABC once said, what's all that about then? Welcome, Rick Astley.
What is all that about then? How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. Now, I suppose the first question is, what were you doing with yourself between 93 and 2007, apart from family life and with your daughter Emily?
Well, to be honest, you've hit the nail on the head there, really. I just wanted to have a bit of a normal life. And I was really, obviously, very, very fortunate and lucky to, you know, do what I did in you know, that 4 or 5 years of pop music. And I just wanted to get away from it all, really, and just be a normal, well, I was never going to be a completely normal dad after what had happened, I guess, really. It was going to take a few years for that to die down, but that's what I wanted to do. You should see my garage, by the way.
Yes.
Place for everything and everything in its place.
Oh, well, I'll tell you, such a neat guy, hey?
Yeah.
Was it true, actually, that you were on the way to London Airport and you said no thanks and turned it round, or is that just
pretty much, yeah. Yeah, no, it was true, yeah. I was in a car with our manager and we were going to New York to do a big TV show there and what have you, and I've just had enough. And it had been building for a while. It wasn't like a, you know, just a split decision like that. It had been going on for a while, and I didn't really want to get on planes anymore. I developed a fear of flying, and I do fly now, and I'm sort of okay with it. I don't love it, but I'll do it. And but you know, back in the day, I was doing it almost every day, and you know, we'd had our daughter by that stage as well, and I just thought, you know what, there's more to life than this. There really is. And I'd counted myself lucky. You know, in pop music, you know, most people get their 15 minutes, as they say. And I just kind of thought, you know what, it's like the good boxers know when to quit. I'm going to quit. So that was it, yeah.
And like Andrew Strauss has just said about quitting the England cricket team. So
yeah, I just saw that, actually. Yeah. It's. But again, you know, I think there are some similarities with sports people in the sense that what they do, you know, they go onto the field to play or whatever it is that they do, and that's what they do. But the reality of it today is there's so much more that they have to do in terms of media and just, you know, they're always got to be on, as it were. You know what I mean? It's not just about doing that anymore. And that's the same with music, I think. It takes an awful lot of your life up to actually just every now and again get on a stage and sing. You know what I mean? And listen, I'm lucky to have been in that position. Of course I am. But yeah. I think for me, I just wanted to just sing. And that's kind of what I do these days. I do more playing live now than I ever did when I was like proper famous. Do you know what I mean?
Wow.
So it's, yeah, definitely. Yeah. So
how did Pete Waterman come to see you in the band FBI then?
Well, my old managers knew Pete from years before. And Pete also had a girlfriend up in the little town that I'm from. And which was just a bizarre coincidence. It's strange, all of that, to be honest. Very weird. He knew a DJ who had a record store that was above a hairdresser's, and she had the hairdresser's, and blah, 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 blah. So it's just weird, you know. But he wasn't the kind of, like, huge mogul at that point that he became. So, but he had red leather trousers, and he had a red Jag. So, I mean, what more do you want? You know what I mean? That is rock and roll, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Or rock and pop. So
in his case, yeah.
Yeah, so I just kind of thought, you know, well, I'll give it a go. I mean, what have I got to lose? And 12 months later, you know, we kind of had like a really big record on our hands. So it's a bit strange, really. I kind of just signed up with Pete because I thought I'd get to live in London for a few months and it'd be a bit of a fun, you know. So
like they all do, they think it's only going to last for a short time.
You
ask the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, they thought it was only going to last this year.
Wow, yeah, bizarre.
Now, you look at the single from New Year's Day 87, obviously Never Going to Give You Up, but surely, Rick, the album, Whenever You Need Somebody, was the one that really put you on the map. I mean, it cracked you the US market, 15 million copies worldwide of that album.
Mm,
I mean,
yeah.
Was that really what put you on the map, do you reckon?
Yeah, I think you mentioned America there, and I think it's always been a bit of a holy grail, I think, for British and non-American acts to kind of, you know, do okay there, and it is a really weird thing, I think, because since we had the first song, you know, we had a couple of number ones there after each other and stuff, and a few other hits and stuff, and I think after that first one, everybody else then, every other country kind of thing, kind of treats you differently. All of a sudden you're kind of, I don't know, it's hard to explain, it's a funny feeling, but I remember coming back to do the Royal Variety and Jimmy Tarbuck, you know, was kind of like, here's an English lad who's showing him how to do it in America. I'm just thinking, like, you know, it was just weird, it was a totally different, it just put you on a different level, really. So, and I used to love going to America, I still do, I go there quite regularly, and I don't know, you know, it's a lot of the culture that you know, I grew up with, music and films and all the rest of it, you know, it's from there, and I used to just love going there, you know, so, yeah.
I think that's very true. I mean, as a stat here, I don't know how true this is, but I saw somewhere, it said between 87 and 89, you outsold every other artist in the world over those 3 years.
I would think that's got to be wrong, hasn't it? There's got to be some massive artists out there.
That's a stat that came my way.
Listen, I'll accept it. I'll keep coming. Tell me more. Tell me more.
Tell
two positives, as Alan Partridge would say. Yeah.
Well, certainly, you succeeded in America and Robbie Williams didn't. Let's go that
way.
Yeah,
but I also think, to be fair, I actually read Robbie's autobiography, and I think he got to a stage pretty early on where he just thought, I just don't need this. I'll just come and live here instead.
Yes.
I mean, that's genius. If you ask me, that's a clever guy. It's like, you know what, I won't break America then. I've tried, I've given it a go, it's all a bit... He doesn't need to, you know what I mean? He's the biggest artist in the world, never mind America. So I think in a way, you know, he's kind of managed to... He's not anonymous in America, obviously, not by a long shot, but I think he can have some sort of a quieter life there than if he lived... You know what I mean? So,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
a bit of a side issue. Not so long ago, I was having the pleasure of interviewing Sir Cliff Richard, and he said about failing in America, and he was so humble with me, Rick. He said his record company, EMI America, actually contacted him and said, "Do you know what, Cliff? They don't like your music in America." And I thought, for him to say that...
Wow.
You know, he said that he would have had to sacrifice a lot of time away from the UK market, which was big for him, to go over there and do that, you know, but that was it.
No, well, that was one of the things I did for sure. I used to spend a lot of time in America, but like I say, I loved it, you see, so it wasn't, it certainly wasn't a chore or anything. I mean, when you're doing, you know, a lot of the stuff that I did, let's say in Los Angeles, you're kind of waking up to a swimming pool in the hotel and like 80 degrees and you just kind of think, yeah, I can stay here for a few weeks, that's no problem, you know what I mean? Yeah. So I loved it really, yeah, it's great.
And you also got through in America as well, writing some of your own songs. I mean, a lot of people thought, you know, Stock Aitken Waterman did it all. But, I mean, She Wants to Dance With Me, you know, that was a big song. I mean, we like that. And there was a number of them that you managed to put on the albums, didn't you?
Yeah, I used to write songs from when I was a kid, really. And I think Pete Waterman, especially, he obviously had like a real kind of map for what he wanted for the team of guys, and I knew that, and I was cool with that. I understood, like I said before, you know, I just thought I'd give it a go and see what happened. Yeah. They just happened to become the biggest producers in the world in the time from when they signed me to when they released my first record. So, but when I got signed to, Pete wanted me to sign to a major label, and when the guys from RCA, as it was then, came to kind of have a listen to me and all the rest of it, I just sang over some of my old demos because we hadn't recorded anything.
Right.
And the guy, a guy called Peter Robinson, his name was, from RCA, said, I quite like these songs as well. And as quick as a flash, without any delay whatsoever, Pete Waterman just sort of said, oh, he's a great writer as well. And I don't think he ever had any intention of any of the artists writing, but yeah, he had a choice, obviously, but I think he just... That's the way Pete is. He's always thinking. He's always got something on his mind, you know. So, yeah. And because of that, you know, I got a few tunes to actually go on the albums, and I got a couple of singles, yeah. So,
that's right. Cool. Because I've always thought, as far as Rick Astley is concerned, you were always a soul fan wanting to get out.
I think a lot of the stuff that I listened to in my later teenage years and what have you, definitely was a lot of R&B, American R&B and stuff, or R&B as it was, what it was then. I mean, R&B's got many forms these days, I guess. But I think what it is that a lot of my... I guess, favourite singers, people like Al Green and stuff like that. Whether you like to admit it or not, we all pinch things from our favourite singers, I think. You know, you end up having some voice of your own, but there's always bits of other things in there. Luther Vandross was one of my favourite singers. But I also think, you know, there's certain styles and certain things that... certain artists just do unbelievably well, and it's almost like so comfortable for them, it's no effort whatsoever. And I think, you know, I obviously I've had my hits doing pop music and whatever because that's the producers that I was with, but in a way, yeah, I perhaps would have liked to have made a record or two, you know, with American producers as well and done it that way. But you know you just have to go with what's in front of you a little bit sometimes. So
now I mentioned a little earlier about Martin Fry and Peter Cox and people like that. Now you've been involved in these Here and Now tours. Now these are massive, aren't they? I mean, you look at the places, the arenas that you guys played at.
Yeah.
There I mean, the 60s guys tour a lot, but the 80s, whenever they go out on the road, they put a package of about six of you together, like Belinda Carlisle or others will be in there, and you really do grab the audiences, don't you?
Yeah, it's kind of strange, really. I think there's just a I don't know exactly what it is, and obviously the 90s are going to have their day at some point as well, but I think right now the 80s are pretty strong, I guess. Yeah. Yes. And I've done a couple of the Rewind ones as well, and yeah, we just did the one at Henley, which is massive. There's like 30,000 people go to that.
I know.
And that's, it's like doing Reading Festival, but with kind of 80s pop music. You know, it's kind of, it's bonkers. You know, the size of it is just bonkers. It's a slightly older audience, obviously, a more discerning audience, I would say. But it's a big thrill to do that, you know. But I like doing the other side of it as well, which is when I do my own little gigs and stuff, because there's an intimacy there that you can't kind of replicate in front of all those people. I was just in Europe doing a couple of gigs, one in Budapest and one just outside Hanover, and both those gigs, especially the second one, the audience are about 25 foot away from you.
Oh, wow.
That's the front line of them. And it's kind of, so in a way, you kind of probably perform in a slightly different way because you're trying to fill a field full of people with your personality. But, you know, so it's kind of nice to juggle it a bit. And I've got a tour in Australia later on in the year.
Yeah.
And obviously that's going to be much smaller venues than that. But, you know, it's nice to mix and match it, really. So.
It is, and good to get down there. Now, apparently, the Her Majesty's Customs and Revenue have been on because they've said, Rick, that you've earned £8 from this Rick Rollin' as by way of royalties off YouTube. Now, I mean, that's a lot of money. So there's going to be probably 40% tax on that. So you'll probably walk away with a fiver. But and who on earth started this Rick Rollin'?
You know what? It's credited to a few different people, but I think there's one guy in particular in America, and he kind of, I forget his name right this second, actually, but he obviously just chose that song for various reasons, probably because he thought the video was pretty cheesy and all the rest of it or whatever, and you know, I'm not complaining, because it kind of introduced that song to a whole generation of new people, which is kind of nice, and yeah. I think there's a sense of irony about the way that people appreciate it, perhaps, but... But I also think, you know, I think certain tunes do have a life of their own, and you can't, you know, Rick Rollin' could have been Dave Rollin' if he would have chosen a song by someone else. So you know what I mean? It hasn't really got anything to do with me, and I think that's the only way that I can look at it, really. It's got a life of its own, and it's just a bit odd, I think, because obviously, you know, that song was kind of, like I say, I don't know, it's very strange being the Rick in Rick Rollins, you know what I mean? But wow. Like I say, I've tried to kind of just let it get on with itself, really, so...
As everybody else does. Rick, it's been great talking to you. I mentioned right at the top of the interview about the album that's selling 15 million copies. And what I'd like to play as a closeout here is the title track from that album, Whenever You Need Somebody, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely, yeah, sure. Bring it on.
Rick Astley, it's been super talking to you. You have yourself a great 8-date tour. And if you're ever down this way near to Verwood and Bournemouth, you come and see us.
Will do. Thank you very much for having me.
Livewire is produced by Steve Osborne Media.